From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On this Memorial Day, more tough news out of Iraq. Two suicide bombers detonated themselves in a crowd of Iraqis south of Baghdad, killing 27, pushing the Iraqi death toll in the last month over 700. At least 70 U.S. troops have been killed in May, making it the deadliest month for the U.S. military since the run-up to Iraq's January elections. Four more American military downed in a crashed Iraqi aircraft today. More than 2 years after the invasion of Iraq, 139,000 American troops are still in deep in what some call the sandbox. Over 1,600 American soldiers have died. Tonight we talk with the reporters who have lived side by side with the troops, sharing their patrols and Humvees. Solomon Moore of the Los Angeles Times, James Janiga of the Chicago Tribune, Gina Cavallero of the Army Times, and Ellen Nickmeyer of the Washington Post. They have seen the firefights, been there for the raids on homes, been there with the U.S. troops dreaming of their own homes far from Iraq, been there as these soldiers survived and as they died. Tonight on Point, the life, death, and dreams of American soldiers in Iraq from the reporters who cover them firsthand. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Solomon Moore, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spent 7 weeks in Iraq and returned 10 days ago. He was embedded for 3 weeks with the U.S. Marines 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marine Division in Al-Anbar Province, stretching west toward the Syrian border, where U.S. efforts have been focused in recent weeks. Solomon Moore, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Also joining us from Chicago, James Janiga, reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He was also in Al-Anbar, embedded for nearly 2 months with the U.S. Marine Regimental Combat Team 2. He returned from Iraq 11 days ago, May 19th. James Janiga, thank you for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you.
Solomon Moore, there's so much going on these days in Iraq, and it's been a very bloody time. But I want to just, with everyone tonight, get a sense of how the troops are doing. It was your first experience of being embedded with U.S. troops in Iraq, with Marines. What was your sense of these young men that you saw going into action in the West, in Al-Anbar?
Well, they were a pretty positive bunch, I have to say. I mean, you know, there was lots of gallows humor to go around, but I found them to be pretty enthusiastic about what they were doing. Often, you know, really kind of impatiently waiting to get into some action. And I think that was the most frustrating thing for them, especially on the campaign that I went along with them on. They were really looking for something to prove themselves on, and they found basically a guerrilla army that was just nowhere to be found.
You quote a Major Steve White saying, "Fighting these guys, that is the insurgents, is like picking up water." That sounds like a tough chore.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they're faced with. They're faced with guys who are going to hit them and then run. And rarely do they kind of hold their ground and fight back. I mean, that's just not been their strategy.
James Janiga, what's your sense? You've been in Iraq a lot. I think this was your third tour through. You were there for a long time embedded this time. We want to get into a lot of detail tonight, but the first just broad question is, how were these troops that you were with doing? How are they holding up?
Well, I think Solomon's read is right on. These are troops that, for most of their time in Iraq, and the current Marines that are in Anbar Province, where the both of us were, and Ellen Nickmeyer of the Washington Post, where the three of us were, these Marines had gotten there in February and had been looking for the insurgents that every day had been laying mines and setting IEDs for them. To actually get into a fight with them is actually something that the Marines looked forward to doing. On the other hand, these engagements have been frequent, and the pace of these engagements, from the contact I've had by email, even since I've come back to the United States, the sense I have is that the Marines are, you know, now that they're in these frequent engagements, they're a little bit tired because there's so much of Anbar Province to patrol and so few of them to patrol it.
Solomon Moore, you write about how even as Al-Anbar has become the focus of U.S. military efforts there, there's been a steady drawdown, quiet drawdown of Marine troop strength.
Yeah, and I don't know how much of that is reflected in actual numbers or if that's just sort of the perception. I mean, certainly there has been somewhat of a drawdown, and there has been deployments elsewhere in the country from Anbar to other places like Baghdad, for instance.
You write about how a year ago there were about 3,600 in the area there, now 2,100. That looks like a pretty significant reduction.
Yeah, and it's been a quiet kind of sapping away of Marine strength in that area, but it's hard to say what the strategy is there. I talked to some Marines who were just saying, well, this is, you know, the beginning of the withdrawal, but at the same time, you have the Marines really engaged in a lot of fights all around the country.
You quote a Major Mark Lister there, senior Marine Air officer, saying, basically, we've got all the toys, I guess he means by that equipment, but not enough boys. Can you feel that on the ground? When the Marines are out on patrol, when they're out on missions, do they feel thin?
They do feel thin. I mean, you can definitely see that, and you can hear them talking of it. I mean, as Lister said, I mean, they do have equipment. They have a lot of hardware, but what they need more of, they say, is bodies. They need more Marines on the ground.
James Janiga, do you hear that complaint among the troops that you've been with? We need more bodies.
Constantly. When I was up with the 3rd Battalion, 2nd Marines in Al-Qaim, before the Operation Matador, I was talking with their operations officer, who had said, he put this map of the area that they had to control, and it was something like, you know, call it 500 square miles. He said, if I lined up every Marine that I have in this battalion, it would stretch for roughly a mile and a half if I, you know, put them within sight of each other.
Yeah.
And you look at the enormity of that area that they're supposed to be responsible for and seek out the enemy in, and you get an appreciation for just how difficult a task, if not impossible, that is. The head of the Marines there, the colonel in charge of the Regimental Combat Team 2, Colonel Steve Davis, is fond of actually using that as a rallying cry for his troops, for his officers, by saying we are a regiment in what a division would normally call a battle space, and it really is. It's enormous. It's something the size of South Carolina, with something on the order of 3,000 or 4,000 Marines to patrol it.
James, help us understand the day-to-day life of the Marines when they were on the mission that you joined them on there in Al Anbar. It can easily back here be reduced to headlines and just numbers. What is it like when they're there? They're pushing west toward the Syrian border. What's their daily existence like? What's the pattern of it?
Solomon would probably be a better person to describe that, because he was actually with them for more of it, or Ellen would. But I'll tell you, it's hot and it's crowded. When there's fighting going on, they ride to it in these armored personnel carriers. And there's something like 17 or 18 in the back of every one of these things. There's no room to put your legs down. There's no shoulder room. There's no, you know, there's no personal space whatsoever. It's perfectly utilitarian. You're riding in this hot metal box into a battle until the ramp drops and these Marines run out and do their thing, clearing from house to house. They have a lot of equipment that they carry with them. They have a lot of responsibility. They have a lot of things on their mind. It can be very dangerous, but it's suddenly dangerous. Most of the time, it's monotonous and it's tedious and it's uncomfortable.
Solomon, when they're pushing forward, as they did in this operation, where do they sleep? Where do they eat? What's the structure of their time?
Well, their time doesn't have a whole lot of structure. I mean, there's a lot of hurry up and wait in the armed forces. And as James said, I mean, they basically live out of the vehicles that they're traveling in, these amphibious armored personnel carriers. They eat whenever and wherever they can. The MRE is ever present, and the Marines are always looking for the best one, whether it be the beef stew or the chicken teriyaki. They fight over those, and they'll just, wherever they can, catch rest, catch sleep, catch a cigarette. There's a lot of banter.
And once they cross the Euphrates into the action here, do they have any forward bases, any well-defended bases there, or it's all kind of on the road, out of the vehicles?
Yeah, north of the Euphrates, they don't have any major bases. They just make camp where they can, and from once in a while they'll commandeer a home. They'll tell the folks who live there to go. They'll pay them a small amount of money, which isn't so small to them, perhaps, and they'll take over a house and stay there for the night if it's tactically safe for them.
And when that happens, did you see that kind of interaction? Do the Iraqis whose home has been commandeered end up feeling all right? Is the house trashed? Or what's the kind of interaction with the Iraqis there?
Well, the Marines try to make as small a footprint as possible, but that can be tough when you have dozens of young men, you know, kind of coming in with their gear. The Iraqis, I've seen various reactions from them. I mean, I've seen some of them be very gracious hosts and remove themselves very willingly. I've seen others with hurt feelings, kind of, you know, going away a little more sullen about the whole matter.
And the soldiers, at least they get a night with a roof over their head there.
Yeah, they do. They do. And, you know, often they are sleeping under the open sky just as often as they're sleeping in somebody else's house, though.
Solomon, I know we have to let you go in a moment. No one knows how long this is going to go on. Can you see the possibility of this going on for years? Can you see the soldiers holding up under that kind of sustained deployment like this?
Well, I can. I think they expect to be there for a long time to come. I mean, they're basically hoping that the Iraqi security forces will be trained up and be able to take their place, but that's not going to happen anytime soon, and I think many of them understand that.
On this Memorial Day, we are talking tonight about American soldiers living, dying, and dreaming in Iraq, talking with reporters who have shared their patrols and their Humvees. Solomon Moore with the Los Angeles Times just came back from a long stint in the West. And Alon Bar, Solomon, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Welcome.
And James Janiga, please stick with us with the Chicago Tribune back 11 days ago from Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Much more to come. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about U.S. troops in Iraq, how they live, how they die, and how they are doing as that war stretches now into its third year. We're joined tonight by reporters who have shared their patrols and Humvees, been up close and personal with the many American troops still in Iraq. We're joined tonight from Chicago by James Janiga, reporter for the Chicago Tribune, just back from Iraq 11 days ago. He was there for 2 months most recently, embedded with the U.S. Marine Regimental Combat Team 2. This was his third trip to Iraq. We're joined now as well from Washington by Gina Cavallaro. She's a reporter for the Army Times. She's done 4 reporting tours through Iraq, been embedded there a total of 10 months in the country and counting from January to the end of March. She was in North Central Iraq, embedded with U.S. Army's 1st Infantry Division, also with the 42nd Infantry Division, a National Guard unit out of New York. Gina Cavallaro, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on your program, Tom.
I want to put the broad question to you that I'm opening, giving to everyone tonight. Just how are these young men generally, not all so young in the National Guard, but how are they doing? This is stretching out. It's long. We're headed back into summer. How are the troops doing?
Well, I think they're doing remarkably well. In the time that, in the last 2 years, what I've seen is a steady improvement in their living conditions over there. And also, I think that now that they've settled into a regular rotation, it's a long rotation, and it's difficult to be away from family and away from the comforts we know here at home for a full year, including all the preparation time it takes to get to that deployment. They settle in once they get over there, and they get to work. But I think the more comfortable conditions, the better food, the air conditioning, the heating, the access to telephones and internet has made a huge, huge difference in the quality of life over there. Morale is better than you'd think.
But Gina, even with all that, I'm looking here at something written by Army Specialist Darian Anderson, a 27-year-old West Virginian back not long ago from Iraq, about things that she will not miss about Army life in Iraq. She says, 1 a.m. mortar attacks, 2 a.m. mortar attacks, 3 a.m. mortar attacks, bad food, dust storm, dust in my hair, my coffee, my lasagna, my eyes, my teeth, people who stare, Charlotte, my M16, she's named her rifle, and sitting next to a box of grenades and trying to pretend that it doesn't freak me out. I mean, even when things are good, the reality is those mortar attacks and all the rest are right there, Gina.
Well, that's true. We're living a pretty comfortable life here in the States. We don't really know what it's like to live like that. I don't know if it was like that in Iraq before we all got there, but she's right. She's all of that stuff is true. The mortar attacks are really frightening because they're so indiscriminate. And your instinct when you hear that thud of an incoming is to run somehow to try to take cover, but you realize that your best bet is to either stay where you are and lie flat, keep walking and hope it doesn't come near you, because if you run, you could be running straight into it. All the living spaces over there are sandbagged all the way around up above the level of the cot or the bunk beds that they're sleeping in. The dining facilities are surrounded by these very tall concrete barriers known as Texas barriers. I mean, they've done a tremendous amount of force protection over there. But yeah, if it's your time, I mean, it is a war, and the Americans are getting attacked. And that soldier probably feels the way a lot of soldiers do. But like I said, they really just settle in. And it can be nerve-wracking over there. There's no question about it. I'm sure James will feel the same way.
James, I wish you'd describe for us exactly where and how the soldiers are living. 139,000 is a lot. We saw those images immediately after the invasion of soldiers frolicking in palaces, around pools, and in great kind of, I don't know, ballrooms or lobbies. Now there's this whole network of camps. I mean, Camp Victory in Baghdad, Camp Anaconda, Camp Q West, Camp Buka. What are these camps? Where are the bulk of American soldiers living?
I'll tell you, there was this great traveling companion I had. He was a Marine Lieutenant Colonel named Ken DeSimone, who summed it up by saying, Iraq is where you are. In you know, the bulk of American soldiers are around Baghdad and in the corridor that's north of there, up towards Tikrit. You know, you have a lot of army bases there that are, you know, Camp Anaconda in Balad, which is north of Baghdad. You have Saddam's former palace in Tikrit, which is quite nice. And, you know, there's a, you know, they're living inside of hardened buildings for the most part, inside of former palaces or guest palaces, if you will. And, you know, they have running water and shower tents and things. There is a quality of life that uniformly at the major bases has been improved. Gina's quite right. Anywhere you go. The Marines out in Anbar live a slightly more Spartan life. They still have shower trailers and flush toilets in the trailers. They're living themselves in, you know, what amount to mobile homes in Al-Asad Air Base, for instance, or in hardened buildings and some of the other smaller encampments that they have. But it is a Spartan existence the further out away from the capital that you get, until you're sleeping on the floor in places like Walid and Trabil on the Jordanian and Syrian borders. Mm-hmm. But at least there's a building there for you to sleep in. A lot of times when they're on patrols, which is roughly half of the time in many of these units, they're sleeping on the ground. You know, there's no sleeping bag, there's no cot, there's no sleeping pad. They're sleeping in the dust. And it can really vary depending on where you are, how well you live,
if you're far from those centers. Gina, one of the remarkable things about this war with the National Guard, the large National Guard deployment, is that you have American soldiers fighting in Iraq who also served in Vietnam, amazingly, and are making comparisons between the two. I see a story here from Solomon Moore's colleague, Monty Morin, where they're making quite positive comparisons between the two, saying, you know, Vietnam was leftover World War II sea rations and lots of drafted soldiers who absolutely didn't want to be there, and pretty tough conditions. They're saying now in the settled American facilities, they've got hot meals, air-conditioned dining facilities, televisions, DVD players, video games, leather couches, refrigerators, stereos, and internet connections. That doesn't sound like the image of forward camps in Vietnam.
No, it doesn't. They also have, I think, which is the one of the best, it could almost be considered a force multiplier because of what it does to the morale of the soldiers and the Marines that I've met, and that's the access to telephones. I mean, you don't even have to go as far back as Vietnam. If you look at the first Gulf War in 1991, I talked to a soldier who said, you know, even 2 years ago in Iraq, a soldier said, that he, in 3 months, hadn't talked to his wife. And then now in Iraq, he had been there a month and he had talked to her three times. So there are, the army has just steadily improved, I think, conditions for all soldiers, not just since Vietnam, but even since the beginning of this particular war, and certainly since the Gulf War. I used to say 12 years ago, but it's more than that now. Time just flies by.
It does. James Janik, I want to ask you on that same front. I mean, one of the things that we see here, Iraq has been declared a no-booze zone for American troops. Troops face harsh punishment if they're caught drinking. And they're talking here with an American National Guardsman who also served in Vietnam, saying there, drinking, smoking, womanizing was the way it was. Now, all that is unheard of. It sounds like it's phone connections, as Gina says, internet connections, video games, DVDs, maybe less Sin City, but also kind of weirdly disconnected from that patrol once you head out the gate.
She's quite right. I mean, back on the base, I'm amused at the idea of booze and women and smoking, but smoking still exists and chewing tobacco, of course. To have the access to the telephones and to the internet is certainly one way for people to stay in touch. It's also one way for people to there are ways that soldiers and Marines, being innovative young lads and lasses, have of getting illicit materials. It can happen. It can happen in those bases. It's easier to get it the further rear you are. Mm-hmm. But it is quite I think the direction you're going. The question is, it's quite a disconnect once you leave the gate. It can be quite different. Yes.
I'd like to point out also that what the soldiers are under is called General Order 1. There, it's just no drinking. Nobody drinks. It's something that is an order that comes probably from CENTCOM or the Pentagon.
Yeah,
or something.
We got it. Yeah.
The other thing is Vietnam. Today we have an all-volunteer army. Those soldiers volunteered to be there, and it can be a nasty place. But it's just it's a different army than it was back in Vietnam. I mean, those soldiers and Marines and sailors back then, a lot of them were there against their will or because they were told they had to go.
They were drafted and thrown to the front.
Yeah, you're looking at a pretty professional, decidedly professional army at this point, and Marine Corps, who are very well trained. And actually, I just wanted to point out that on Super Bowl Sunday, there was some beer. I won't mention the division.
Yeah, and James
they know
points
who they
out,
are.
Right? Yeah, especially
they were allowed two beers.
Get to the rear, and in it comes. But it can come right through the front gate if you're not careful, Gina, James. We were just reading over the weekend about a U.S. heavily fortified base north of Baghdad where last week Iraqi insurgent assailants had three successive waves of suicide bomb, explosives-loaded cars that went for that front gate one after the other. They were turned back, but it sounded like a close thing. And Gina, you've been on the patrols when they go out, and it can be brutal.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when you go into a Humvee and you leave that front gate, you're pretty much, you're in the same risk, you run the same risk the soldiers do. It's not really, I wouldn't feel safer if I were armed. I'm perfectly comfortable around trained armed teenagers. I think that's fine, but the roadside bombs and the car bombs are always a threat. I mean, when you're a reporter and you decide to go to Iraq and live with the troops, you're really, I mean, it's dangerous over there. No matter how you slice it, you could lose a limb or you could lose your life just like they do.
Gina.
Yes.
I wish you'd tell us the story of Francisco Martinez, a young soldier that you got to know and who ultimately died. I wish you'd share that story.
Yes. I've shared this story actually previously with some NPR listeners shortly after I got back from Iraq at the end of March. Specialist Martinez was a field artillery. I mean, he was a forward observer. He was attached to an infantry company. This is out in Ramadi. And on March 20th, on a patrol, he was shot by a sniper. We were standing not exactly side by side, but He had become my shadow. He was 20 years old, and he decided he was going to be the soldier who walked alongside and kind of kept an eye out for me.
Your families both had roots in Puerto Rico. You shared a lot in the time you were together.
Yes, we went on two patrols together, and I'm sure as James and the other reporters who have been over there will attest, when you spend any time with the troops and living with them and sleeping with them and waking up with them and scrounging for coffee and whatever, the quick bonds are formed out there. And he was just one of those kids. We struck a bond. And so on our second patrol, ironically, we were out looking for a sniper that had already killed three other soldiers and wounded some other ones. And we were looking for that sniper in Ramadi. And when they didn't find him in the one place they thought they would, we kept walking and patrolled this neighborhood. And as we were standing in front of this one house, a shot rang out. I was certain that it was a negligent discharge from another soldier's rifle because it was so close. But when I turned around and saw Martinez lying on the ground, I just froze.
How had he been hit, Gina?
The bullet seemed to have gone in just to the side of his armor plate in his back, kind of through his ribs, and you know, he fell straight back. He was still alive. He was alive all the way to the Altacottam hospital, you know, through a medevac flight. But his wounds were internal, and it was catastrophic. But I rode with him in the Humvee back to the aid station at Camp Ramadi, and I held his hand and I spoke to him in Spanish. And I mean, I just didn't really know what to do. There was another soldier with me. He was holding the bandages, PFC Johnson. And the two of us just sort of held Martinez together on that ride. And it was a really bloody scene, I'll tell you. I hadn't really seen anything like that before, and certainly not that intimately. But he did die about an hour later, and I was just crushed. He was supposed to live, actually. The medics thought that he would live, but it was just catastrophic, and he didn't really have a chance.
You know, Gina, that was the first time for you to see that. For the soldiers there, many of them will have seen it repeatedly. How does that awareness, that even if you've got your surf and turf night and your internet access and your DVDs right outside the gate is that threat, that potential death, how do they carry that knowledge?
That's a very, very good and very pointed question, especially today on Memorial Day. I don't think any soldier ever forgets anything like that. What that did was give me a really intimate understanding of what they go through, and they've got to get up the next day and go on patrol again. They might go past that same site. And some soldiers see much worse than I saw, and I don't really know how they cope with it. They've got a lot of support mechanisms. They've got combat stress specialists who will really know what they're doing. The chaplain is always there. Sometimes it's just, you know, talking with the commander. The commander's bearing the brunt of it, too. Commanders go through a deep, deep sorrow when they lose a soldier, and it's just so difficult for everyone. They go through it together. They have each other. They hold their memorial services where the roll call is read and the name is called out and the soldier doesn't answer. And it's very sad, but it's a process that helps them deal with that loss. And they know that if they go, they're going to be afforded the greatest respect. That it kind of keeps them going. They're in it together. It's very, very difficult, though. It's just not something you can just forge on ahead with. Memorial Day means a lot to them. I mean, look, we've got a whole generation of young soldiers and Marines now who know firsthand, who have seen their buddies get killed. And Memorial Day really, really is taking on a whole new meaning in this country now, I think. I hope it is, anyway.
James, they may be bearing up well under that, but back home you know what the recruitment numbers are like. Young Americans are not signing up in the numbers to help them meet their goals. It's not translating back to the States in a way that, apparently, that looks very appealing.
Well, I don't expect you know, I don't know what to expect that you know, that would make that appealing. I think there is still a sense of patriotism in a lot of places that is still fueling recruits. The numbers overall are down, yet somebody is still enlisting. I mean, you know, people still are joining the armed forces.
Somebody, but on this Memorial Day, not enough to fill the ranks. James Janiga, Gina Cavallaro, please stand by. We're talking tonight about American soldiers in Iraq, how they live, how they die, how they're doing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on this Memorial Day about American soldiers living, dying, and dreaming in Iraq with reporters who have shared their patrols and Humvees. We're joined right now by Gina Cavallaro. She's a reporter for the Army Times, had several trips to Iraq back recently, and James Janiga with the Chicago Tribune, back from Iraq on May 19th. Spent 2 months embedded there, most of the time recently, in Al-Anbar province with the U.S. Marine Regimental Combat Team 2. This was his third trip to Iraq. James, you described in mid-May just one of many incidents there when an M1 Abrams tank was disabled by a roadside explosive, and the difficulty, the kind of chaos that comes in to efforts simply to operate in Iraq sometimes. Take us to that scene, if you could.
This is in a small town just south of the Euphrates River during Operation Matador, and a tank was defending the only bridge that existed in the area, aside from the ones that the Americans built to begin this attack. There was a bridge, a very small bridge that crossed the Euphrates there. The Americans had set up blocking positions on either side of that to prevent insurgents from moving back and forth across the river with great ease. The insurgents, of course, realized the strategic importance of that and had heavily mined the area and set IEDs along that area and were able to disable an M1 tank and sat there for a day and a half, you know, well defended, of course, and
but a big tank not able to move.
Yeah, it took a wheel off of a big tank. The tank is unable to move. So a rescue vehicle, they have tank recovery vehicles, had come out to find it, and a convoy of vehicles had come out to move it. And the convoy that came to their rescue was itself came under attack in the streets of this town, sort of claustrophobic streets with you know, buildings going by just on either side of the vehicles as they sped through it, and rockets and gunfire coming down from the roofs around them as they took a wrong turn and were eventually able to escape. During their course of their escape, a suicide bomber drove into their convoy and hit a Humvee, and the passengers of that Humvee were all burned but not killed, and were able to get into the tank recovery vehicle. Another tank was able to buckle itself to the first damaged tank that had been there for a day or so, and they were all able to get out of there, and nobody was killed. It was no Americans were killed. It was just one of those chaotic moments in urban warfare where, you know, anything goes after a point. I mean, you expect certain categories of danger, and they can overlap at any one point in any number of different directions.
We've been trying to get in touch with Ellen Nickmeyer tonight. You know how the phone lines are to Baghdad sometimes,
yeah.
And we're having trouble getting through. Of course, she was there when that first platoon of Lima Company out of Ohio was decimated in that same Operation Matador. An armed vehicle, Amtrak there, hit and blazing on fire. She describes as one of the soldiers looked on there at the inferno where a lot of his colleagues were being burned, just gripping his helmet and screaming, "I hate this country." James, whatever it is back at the base, there have to be times when people just can't stand the constant kind of drip torture of going out, not finding the enemy, being hit by the roadside bomb. It's got to get to people.
That day certainly did, Tom. That was an awful day. Ellen was there, and Solomon were there. I was actually back at the battalion headquarters in Al-Qaim, but the medevac birds began flying, you know, every 5 minutes, and they just kept going for hours. And the mood of the base just changed right away. I was in a position of trust and was inside the command center and was, you know, immediately thrown out, you know, you know, without even a discussion.
As they dealt with that.
Yeah, as
they didn't want a reporter watching this unfold.
Right.
You know.
A guy who actually was a public affairs officer, a young lieutenant, Paul Kroom, was in that vehicle that was hit, and I saw him come back to the base, and both of his arms were heavily bandaged. His face was burned. It seemed not too badly, and I hope it didn't turn out too badly, but at the time it didn't seem too badly, and we talked for much of that evening, and it was terrible. It was a terrible scene where this armored personnel carrier rolled over what was an improvised mine. It was an artillery shell that was wired to a a shock absorber for a car with wood stuck in the shock absorber. It's complicated to explain on the radio, but essentially what happens is several vehicles roll over that shock absorber until the wood finally breaks, the circuit is connected, and the third vehicle that rolled over it was this armored personnel carrier where this artillery round blew up through a diesel cell and up into this crowded compartment in the back of the armored personnel carrier. Several people burned to death or died very shortly after that from the burns they received there. A number of people escaped, and there was nobody to shoot back at.
That's
enormously frustrating to them.
That instant inferno. And then, James, those same soldiers before long are going to be back out on patrol. Ellen writes about them, you know, breaking down doors, which is something American troops spend a lot of time doing, and going in glaring. Sometimes, you know, she describes them saying, you know, Mujahideen Wayne, Ali Baba, I guess that's the slang for insurgents.
Where Iraqi word for thief, yeah.
Right, where are the insurgents? The emotion must run very high after people have seen that kind of incident.
Yeah, I mean, what's different about this incident is that it was an ongoing operation, whereas, you know, most of the time somebody's, you know, doing a convoy run and a bomb goes off and people are hurt and, you know, there's a cooling off period before they're involved in another operation. You know, in this case, it was an ongoing operation. It wasn't shortly after. It was probably immediately after or the next day at the very latest that some of these same soldiers, or Marines rather, who had witnessed this were going to the next small town and knocking on doors. You know, and Gina pointed out earlier on, and she's absolutely right, it needs to be underscored and highlighted. This is a very professional Army. A very professional Marine Corps, very professional military, since it's all volunteer. This is not the drafty military that you had in the Vietnam War. Nevertheless, you know, when that professionalism comes in, is in providing restraint to those emotions, which, you know, naturally, you know, a young teenager is going to want revenge, and that's where having a developed non-commissioned officer corps, that sergeants. Who are with these young men, and a well-developed officer corps, lieutenants and captains, who are holding those Marines back. It doesn't stop the glares, but you know, one hopes that it stops you know, acts of actual physical violence.
Gina, what about the U.S. troops' relationship, interaction with the Iraqis there? Sadly, we know that it's at its extreme end, Abu Ghraib, et cetera. It can be pretty awful, but in the sort of day-in and day-out interaction, whether training Iraqis or patrolling, knocking on doors, as James says, or breaking down the doors, what's your sense of that interaction, how it's holding up? They're clearly hated by some portion of Iraqis. What's the full picture?
Well, that is part of the picture. I think they're having varying degrees of success in training Iraqis to do their own security. I think that there is frustration, and they do hold back because they have rules. The Iraqi fighters don't, and so that's a big source of frustration, because it's really completely asymmetric, not only in the warfare but in the who's accountable for what. I mean, the insurgents do whatever they want, and they're using methods of attacking that. Like, it just breaks my heart to hear about that the Amtrak getting burned up like that,
yeah.
and driving over that piece of wood until it breaks. I mean, how do you guard against that? You can't. It's all in the landscape out there. And so, yeah, there's definitely a lot of resentment, but they do have to hold back. On the other hand, there are big areas where the people are happy that the Americans are there. And that you see it in the children running through the streets after the Humvees as if they were the ice cream man. There's still some hope. I mean, it's not a complete wasteland of hatred against the U.S. It's just such a mess, and the lines are constantly getting blurred. But you know, I think the people who see the news and read the news and they hear about a big bomb or hear about an attack mm-hmm. here and there, you have to understand it's a huge country, and it sounds really scary. But there are areas that you never hear about anymore. I mean, when's the last time you heard about a big attack in a place like, well, you know, hesitate to say it, and then something happens. But
right, even,
you know,
in the South, you've heard of an attack just in the last couple of days.
Yeah, Basra, Nazaria, all these Al-Qut,
sure.
you know,
mm-hmm.
all these towns I've mm-hmm. been to before, and you just don't hear. And I'm glad. I mean, I'm glad there aren't big attacks. But I think the mess moves around.
Though it can be right there in the center, you write about soldiers just on an ordinary patrol in Baghdad walking through this water that you describe as a putrid cocktail of human waste, garbage, and the carcasses of dead animals, and this is just an ordinary day.
Yes, and Alpha, I think it was Alpha Company, had the distinction of having that as their area of operations.
130 degrees, soldiers on patrol gagging and vomiting, just walking through there.
Yeah, I'm sorry I'm missing that.
okay.
I mean, not really, but that would be the 164 armor out of eastern Baghdad, and that's actually an infantry company that is now permanently assigned to that armor battalion. And you know what? They're out there doing they're doing their patrols. They don't like to call them presence patrols, but really what they're doing is kind of looking around to see what the mood is among the people. And you know, that's a huge project to try to put sewer pipes into a neighborhood like that, where for God knows how long that area has been neglected by Saddam Hussein. I mean, that was an area of town that was just neglected during that whole time. And what they have are these gigantic 10-foot deep slit trenches that are filled with raw sewage and garbage, and the pump stations that take that stuff out are not always working because they're either broken or the electricity is sporadic.
But the U.S. troops don't have a choice. They go where the need is. James, we've just got half a minute left here. I want to get your final thought on troops' morale and the way ahead. What's your level of confidence of that morale holding up, that focus holding up?
Right now, they're, you know, in the areas where there is active fighting, there can be strain when the pace is very rapid, when there's a lot of operations, one right after the other. In a lot of other areas, like Tikrit and Mosul and Kirkuk, maybe not Mosul, in Tikrit and Kirkuk, where, you know, there is, you know, you get more of a sense that things are on track there. There's more Iraqi units coming into those areas, and, you know, there is a sense of optimism. All the people that are in the military are can-do people to begin with, and so you have sort of a self-limiting set of opinions. But you know, they feel like they're doing their job.
But it's tough. We're reading a blog out of Iraq just today. A soldier there watching for weapons, he says, rooftops, watching the Iraqis watch us. It starts out in the pit of my stomach, fear and worry mix. Please God, let us make it through. Another one, James Janiga and Gina Cavallaro, thank you very much for taking us closer to that action. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. It's glad to talk to the listeners out there. Thanks.
Good to be with you.
James Janiga with the Chicago Tribune, Gina Cavallaro with the Army Times. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, one American high schooler explains his decision to sign up for the military. This is On Point. The U.S. military has fallen far short of its recruiting goals in recent months. With the Iraq War stretching out, the Army has found itself more than 6,000 recruits short so far this year, and it's not alone. Recently, the Army suspended recruiting for a day to refocus after reports of unethical techniques being used by recruiters desperate to fill their quotas. Massachusetts high school student Jonathan Hatch didn't need a big sales pitch to sign up. A few weeks after his upcoming graduation, Hatch will head out to Army basic training. The question he has heard the most from friends and family since he signed up in February is, why? In this radio diary, 18-year-old Jonathan Hatch explains why he decided to join the Army.
It's the question that seems to be festering in the back of everybody's mind. Why did he join the Army? Why give up the scholarships from 6 colleges? Why join the military where he could get killed? Why is he fighting Bush's war for oil? Why is he throwing his life away in a machine that will turn him into a mindless robot? I've heard all of these and more. I get kind of embarrassed when people ask me, so I always try to tailor my response to what everybody wants to hear. College money, blah, blah, blah. I'm not doing anything dangerous, blah, blah, blah. The silly responses go on and on, but they're not the truth. The truth of the matter is that this is something I've wanted to do since I was a little kid. Servicemen always struck me as modern-day samurai. They protect others and have their own honor code that they try to uphold. I was all set to go to college in New Mexico to study emergency medicine when I received a phone call from a friend of mine, an active duty infantryman. He asked me why I'd given up on my childhood dream. I asked myself the same question and pondered it a while. My 18th birthday came and went, and then I found something that made me grab my jacket and head to the recruiting office. It was an old Boston Globe that I had saved from September 12th, 2001. I saw the pictures in that old paper and remembered. I remember that day, sitting in my Spanish class and hearing our principal, Mr. Wright, come over the intercom. I remember sitting in the school's mezzanine watching the planes hit the towers over and over again. I remember how shocked I was and how I vowed to dedicate my life to doing everything in my power to defend America so that something like that would not happen again. I signed up for the military out of compassion for other human beings. I joined as a 91 Whiskey healthcare specialist, also known as a combat medic. As a medic, I will carry a rifle. While I have the power to kill, I am also morally obligated to treat the enemy, as well as the men in my platoon. I do not relish the idea of killing at all, but I'd rather see a dead enemy than a dead comrade. We are at war. Unfortunately, our generation has been so stigmatized by Vietnam that they believe soldiers are brainwashed and that everyone gets shot at while in the service. At my recruiting station, I met a helicopter mechanic who traveled throughout Iraq and never got shot at. I also met a tank commander who has been shot at countless times and came back from Iraq unscathed. The brainwashing stuff you hear is garbage. I've heard liberal and conservative soldiers alike debate politics and discuss current events. I've also met soldiers who have hobbies, watch Disney cartoons, listen to music, and play with their kids. They're human like everybody else. I'm proud that I'm an American. I'm patriotic and glad to have the honor of serving my country in the Army. That's what this is about. I'm not serving some government, I'm serving the people, and I'm protecting the people from enemies, foreign and domestic. I swore in knowing exactly what I was getting myself into. Am I scared? A little. But I'm always apprehensive about the unknown. We are at war, and I'm proud to be one of the few people who has the guts to stand up and say, "Send me." There will never be another draft, so it's up to people like me who realize when they are needed. That's something I'm proud to be a part of.
18-year-old Jonathan Hatch will graduate from Belmont High School in Massachusetts on Sunday. He will be reporting for duty in the U.S. Army in late June. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.